Today's show is brought to you by Five Nights in Vegas, a new romance by Elizabeth Stokes. It's about meeting, getting married, and falling in love in that order. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On this very lovey-dovey Valentine's weekend, I'm going to be talking about Deadpool, Zoolander 2, How to Be Single, Southbound, and Tumbledown. There'll also be some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, an answer to a listener question, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And of course, I'm always hanging out somewhere on Twitter, even if you don't see me tweeting a whole lot. I'll be there at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
What would be a Fat Guys at the Movies news segment without a little bit of a Star Wars update? I talked about this a little bit last week, but it officially happened that Star Wars finally cracked $900 million domestic and $2 billion worldwide. Now, $900 million domestic has never been done. When adjusted for inflation, it's like number 11. So it's still, even when adjusted for inflation, this is a wildly popular movie. It has beaten almost everything, except for 10 other films. One of them being the original Star Wars. The $2 billion worldwide is significant because even though it's not a certainty that it's going to top Titanic with It's overseas, because it's still got to make like $150 million more in its run to top Titanic's take. And it's not even going to get to Avatar's take. And that's fine. There's nothing bad about the fact that Star Wars didn't break the Avatar world record. What is significant is that it's one of only three movies, with Titanic and Avatar being the other two, to break $2 billion in its total run. And it's only the second to ever do that in a single release, because Titanic didn't top $2 billion until after it had that 3D release a couple years ago. So Star Wars The Force Awakens, big hit. In fact, it was such a big hit, and this is a piece of news that I just found laughable. Lionsgate has come out and basically said, well, you know, the last Hunger Games movie, it didn't do as well as the others, and here's why. It's because Star Wars. Because some people didn't have enough money to go see both Mockingjay Part 2 and Star Wars in the theaters. Even though it's like 10 bucks, 15 bucks to see a movie, you couldn't afford one of them. I understand if they came out the same weekend or 1 week apart, but they were a month apart. There's plenty of time to have seen it. Just people didn't go see the fourth Hunger Game movie because of other reasons. And it's not because of Star Wars that it stole its box office. And it's not because of terrorism. They also claimed that the Paris terrorist attacks impacted this. And that's a bunch of hogwash. The last Hunger Games movie made 50 to 100 million less at this box office. Maybe it's because they split a book that shouldn't have been split up into two movies just for the greedy reason to get more money out of people for no pragmatic story or film reason. Maybe it's because they've alienated a good chunk of their mainstream audience by trying to milk it, and all they got were the diehard fans. It's not even franchise fatigue. It's fatigue of that franchise, because they took one book and split it into two movies, and it was unnecessary. What's interesting is this dovetails into Divergent, which Robert Swanky, who's directing Allegiant, but he's not directing Ascendant, which is the fourth one. Once again, the final book split into two. Divergent has already suffered a bit of franchise fatigue, and it never really took off. I mean, its domestic gross for each of the first two movies, the total was about what the first two Hunger Games each made in their first weekend. Divergent has never broken out. It's mildly broken out. And I think this one's, we'll see what happens in these next two movies. We'll see what happens when Allegiant comes out next month. And then Ascendant might just fizzle completely. Now, in other news of development, you've got Deadpool 2 is already in the works, because the tracking is so good for this movie. People are so excited for this movie that they're already starting to write the script for its sequel. And you see this fast tracking of movies a lot now. It used to be way back, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they'd make a movie, it'd do well, it'd have the whole theatrical run, and then they decide to do a sequel, which is why you had 2, 3, 4 years sometimes between sequels. Now they're trying to capitalize on these franchises and, you know, stuff in the pipeline, which is what Marvel did and Disney's doing with the Star Wars movies. They're hoping to get another Deadpool movie very quickly. So as long as throughout this weekend, the audience and the ticket sales are on track with the tracking, that should be a good thing. And hopefully the people doing the tracking numbers aren't the same people who did Donald Trump's numbers in Iowa, because it could be soft and we may not see a Deadpool sequel if it doesn't do as well as it needs to. Couple other real quick bits of casting news. Johnny Depp has been cast in an Invisible Man remake with Universal. This will be following The Mummy with Tom Cruise, and then the next year being a Wolfman movie was what's being rumored. I'm okay with it. Johnny Depp is an Invisible Man movie. At least they got some quality people behind these films. Will Smith and Martin Lawrence say they're both definitely returning for Bad Boys 3, even though Michael Bay won't be directing. That's a plus for me. Even though I liked 13 Hours, I thought it was a very good movie. He's going to be doing the same 12-year-old filmmaking in Bad Boys because he doesn't take that seriously as he would, you know, real people as American heroes in real life. Brian Fuller, who's known for being the showrunner of series like Hannibal and Dead Like Me, will be running the new Star Trek series on TV, and that's a good thing. Hopefully, he does something better than what it looks like Justin Lin's doing with the Star Trek movie. Who knows? We'll see. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Both of these movies had Super Bowl spots. I can say Super Bowl spots because I'm not marketing it that way. There were spots actually played on the Super Bowl. I find it interesting. You're not allowed to say Super Bowl when you're making your game spots. They always call it the big game spot because Super Bowl is a trademark term. And they don't want people marketing that. So they have to say the big game. I can say they play during the Super Bowl because they did in fact play during the Super Bowl. That would be like saying a Pepsi commercial played during an average NFL game. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2 got a small spot, dropped during the big game, and that is opening on June 3rd.
What are the most important traits of the ninja?
Speed, stealth, and precision.
Hey, buddy!
That doesn't seem so tough.
Where's Rat?
Well, that went well.
I think I covered this one when the first trailer dropped. It actually looks like it could be fun. You got to get past the Uncanny Valley creepy looking turtles in there. And if they keep the fun nature of the first film, it should do okay. I'll be curious to see how long of legs this franchise actually has, because when you're dealing with like a kid show like TMNT, which is a cartoon that has been made into live action movies before, you tend to burn through your audience once the audience grows up, and you kind of have to reinvigorate the audience every few years. That's if you look at what Disney Channel does on the Disney Channel programming schedule, they're always bringing in new shows and bringing in new actors and characters because they need to get the kids and have them. They have the kids and they have their attention for like a 4 or 5 year period, and then they move on. And maybe Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was a big hit back in August of a couple years ago. You know, maybe it's not going to do well in the June timeframe. Who knows? We'll see. I thought it was fun, so I'm hoping that this will be too. The other one is Jason Bourne, the fifth Bourne Identity movie, opens on July 29th.
My God, that's Jason Bourne.
Why would he come back now?
I know who I am. I remember everything.
Remembering everything doesn't mean you know everything.
The world is at war. We need the perfect weapon.
Again, nice to see Matt Damon return as Jason Bourne. This is after a little bit of infighting between whether or not they're going to have Jeremy Renner continue the franchise as in a different mode. Apparently, the Bourne legacy didn't quite click the way they wanted to, even though I enjoyed it to a degree. And they're going back to Matt Damon, and this is his franchise. This is his big one. Ben Affleck's now got Batman, but he's done other things. Matt Damon's really pretty much got the Bourne Identity as a franchise series for him. So You know, it looks like the team's back together, and I like these movies. I generally find them fun, so a late July release could be a good thing. So I'll look forward to this one as well this summer. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to hit the movie reviews with How to Be Single and Zoolander 2. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr rolling into the movie reviews with Fat Guys at the Movies on this Valentine's weekend. I like Valentine's weekend because it's such a bizarre time to release movies. You sometimes get movies, like I remember a couple years ago, oh gosh, what, 6-7 years ago, Dear John came out, and that actually knocked Avatar off of its pillar as its box office king. And being a Nicholas Sparks movie with some hot young actors, Amanda Seyfried and Channing Tatum, that was the big Valentine's Day movie. That was the date movie. But the other thing you see coming out is you see what I like to refer to as anti-Valentine's Day movies. Now, for every movie like Valentine's Day or Nicholas Sparks or Love Story, you have movies like I Hate Valentine's Day or that one He's Not That Into You. These kind of movies tend to do well. And it seems to be a phenomenon driven by the female demographic. When you're in love and you have a significant other, Valentine's Day is great. I personally never leave the house on Valentine's Day. It's always busy. I hate going out in restaurants because it's wait's crazy and it's just a pain in the butt. My wife and I will always celebrate Valentine's Day either the week before or the week after, and nobody's at the restaurants, and you know, it's really kind of nice. But then if you're single, especially if you're a woman and you're on the wrong side of 30 and you're pushing 40 and maybe you're in your 40s or you're in your 50s and maybe you're divorced or whatever, I know a lot of them that just hate Valentine's Day. And they take it personally. And I always find that funny because it's no skin off your nose if somebody else is happy, unless they're doing it at your expense. But in this weekend, we've got some really interesting stuff. You've got an R-rated superhero movie. You've got a big, broad comedy. You've got a political movie. And, you know, like a couple of years ago, they did the RoboCop remake on Valentine's Day weekend, which was bizarre. And at the same time, they had a love story with A Winner's Tale. But this week, we've got How to Be Single. After breaking up with her boyfriend, a young woman's best friend takes her out on the town to show her the perks of the single life.
I know breaking up sucks, but you know what's even worse? Wasting a night in New York City. Give it to me, I'm worth it. Let me teach you how to be single.
You're a pretty girl. This is New York City. There's like a billion people outside that door.
In every male-female friendship, there's total number of drinks.
4, 5.
And if you hit that, it means you will definitely have sex.
If I had more than 5 drinks, I'd hook up with you.
My drink number is 27. I wouldn't even touch myself on less than 24.
This is one of those that appears to be a I Hate Valentine's Day kind of movie. I didn't actually get a chance to see it. And not that the studio didn't show it to us. I'm not dissing the studio here because they made a point to show it. I just had to choose. I had to choose between seeing this and Zoolander 2 early, and Zoolander 2 won out because it was a little bit more buzzworthy. More people want to talk about this movie on the radio than they do the Valentine's Day chick flick. But this one looks typical of the Girls Night Out movie. Now, I like a lot of the people involved in this. I like Rebel Wilson. I like Dakota Johnson, who was in last year's Valentine's Day movie, which was 50 Shades of Grey. I love Alison Brie. I think she's gorgeous. I do not like Leslie Mann. I mean, back when Leslie Mann was like 25 and she was like really, she had youth on her side, she looked really adorable and cute. I couldn't stand her talking, but she was very nice to look at. Now she thinks she's a comedic genius because she's got a lot of movies under her belt. And the reason she's got a lot of movies under her belt is because she's Judd Apatow's wife. So it's not like she's earned it outside of that. I do think it's interesting that Rebel Wilson is essentially getting the Melissa McCarthy roles. And I would love to see Melissa McCarthy and Rebel Wilson do a movie together to see who could be more obnoxious and sexually crass. I tend to like Melissa McCarthy a little bit better. Although I think I like Rebel Wilson's movies better. Who knows? Anyways, How to Be Single. I'm not even going to give it a preemptive suck or a preemptive rock because the studio tried to show it. I just had a conflict. So that's out there. It's an option. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to talk about Zoolander 2 now. This is, of course, the one that I saw instead of How to Be Single. The really, really, really ridiculously good-looking male models, Derek Zoolander and Hansel, are back to uncover a deadly mystery in the fashion world.
Derek Zoolander, I'm with Interpol. I need your help.
She's hot. I trust her.
Someone's trying to kill the world's most beautiful people.
Oh, fudge! Peace out, world.
All of them died with your signature look. This is blue steel, right? We need you to infiltrate the world of high fashion.
We're back!
Yeah! Are you sure Zoolander is the right man to help us?
God help us all.
The hype cycle for something like Zoolander 2 is just amazingly profound because when Zoolander first came out, I thought it was a hoot. I loved Zoolander. I believe Ben Stiller had this character from his days doing sketch comedy. But of course, it got the big launch. It's sort of like his MacGruber. It got a big launch into a movie. And the movie tended to do pretty decently. It came out in 2001. And it worked as a weird, quirky comedy, sort of falling in that zone that Austin Powers was in. Not as a direct spoof, but really doing a send-up of something very specific. And this one, it was a fashion world. And a lot has happened since Zoolander. You had the Bruno movie, which, of course, lampooned the fashion world in a very real and gritty and subversive way. And we've got an even more egregious media culture. When Zoolander first came out, there was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, there was no selfies. Selfie wasn't even a term back then. Well, now we've got everybody who takes a picture of themselves with everything. And the narcissism of our society, I wouldn't say that our society is any more narcissistic than it ever was, but I would say that our society is certainly exposed as being narcissistic now that the tools are there for everybody to get themselves and their face and their body and their uniqueness out. The problem when you do a sequel like Zoolander is the first was just this weird little movie that clicked and it told a decent story. It wasn't a great story, but it actually had a plot, believe it or not. But then you tell this complete story and you've got to do another movie out of it and you have to sort of force this plot in there. And you saw this with Porky's, you saw this with American Pie, you saw this with Horrible Bosses, last year or the year before, where a movie does extremely well, and it's kind of a hit, and then they got to make a movie. Hangover did this as well. They don't know what to do because the story was told already. And now they have to change the happy ever after that was on the tag of the last movie, and you got to do something different. For that, Zoolander 2 is not terribly unique. The story's kind of, it doesn't quite hold together. It has some very clever moments. It has some very funny moments. The whole part of it is they're trying to get Zoolander's son, and his Zoolander son's much smarter than he is, but not nearly as attractive. And so there's this father-son dynamic you got to work through, which is a bit trite, but we've seen that. And Derek and Hansel are older now. And so they're dealing with them being older. So there's all these issues you see in a sequel, especially one for a movie that's a decade and a half old. But it's not really about the plot. This movie, like Derek Zoolander, is very, very ridiculously good looking, but it doesn't quite hold together story-wise. Still, that doesn't matter. It's a funny movie. I enjoyed it. It, to me, is the Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, to Austin Powers, The International Man of Mystery. Austin Powers, the first one, International Man of Mystery, Far and Gone was better than its sequel in every way. But the sequel's still a whole heck of a lot of fun to watch, even though it just fakes the story as best it can. But really, the reason to see this movie is for the absurd comedy, the commentary on the fashion world, and it works. As a social commentary, it works. It just isn't as well-formed and put together. But it was still very, very ridiculously entertaining. So I'm going to have to say that Zoolander 2 kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for these reviews. I'm going to move on into the next segment and talk about Deadpool and Southbound.
Open Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Open Gangnam Style.
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, rolling into the movie reviews. Let's talk about Deadpool. This is the one that everyone's talking about. This has garnered the most buzz of the week. And Zoolander 2 was a very buzzworthy movie, especially when it was first announced. Everyone's like, oh my God, they're finally going to do it, because they've been talking about doing this movie for a dozen years. And then they had a great opening teaser trailer for Zoolander 2. And then the reality of it just being a sequel to a 15-year-old movie kind of settles in. And then, you know, the critics say, well, it's okay. And Deadpool sort of rises above all this. And what's interesting with Deadpool is the evolution of this movie. Started out, Deadpool was sort of a character in X-Men Origins Wolverine. And the thing is, this is not even consistent. This is technically canon for the X-Men movies because they have the Xavier School for Gifted Mutants or whatever it's called. And they've got actual X-Men showing up in the movie. So it exists in that X-Men universe, but it kind of ignores the fact that the character of Wade Williams is different in this, vastly different than the character we saw in X-Men Origins Wolverine. That's okay. And here's the thing you got to realize with superhero movies is just like the comics. I remember reading the comics when I was a kid, and the comics were constantly changing their mythology and altering things and tweaking it. And for this one comic book, they wanted to have XYZ happen, so they needed to make that work. And it was always a very loosey-goosey canon anyways. And they decided to make a Deadpool movie. They decided to give Ryan Reynolds finally a character he can get behind because he has played in Blade Trinity, which was another R-rated comic book movie. He played Green Lantern. He also played the original Deadpool in the series on the film. But they finally said, hey, we're going to do it like the comic. They're going to give him an edgy personality. He's going to be wisecracking. It's going to be R-rated. It's going to be extremely violent. It's going to be crass. It's going to have a lot of dirty jokes. It's going to have some breasts in it. And I give Fox credit. For this whole time, I was like, they're going to green light this, and then they're going to edit as PG-13, and that's how they're going to release it, because that's the safe bet. So I give Fox credit for having the stones to actually release an R-rated X-Men movie, which is essentially what this is. Now, with that said, this does not mean that every action superhero movie needs to be rated R. And this does not mean that every action superhero movie needs to be in the Deadpool mode. What makes Deadpool work is the fact that it's unique. Let's just go ahead and play the trailer, talk a little bit more about it. Ryan Reynolds stars as Deadpool, a snarky and foul-mouthed invincible mutant seeking revenge on the scientist who disfigured him.
You're probably thinking, this was a superhero movie, but that guy in the suit just turned that other guy into a kebab.
Surprise, this is a different kind of superhero story.
If I never see you again, know that I love you.
When I'm finished, your mutated cells will heal anything.
I didn't ask to be super, and I'm no hero. But when you find out your worst enemy is after your best girl, the time has come to be a superhero.
Hear the music.
X-Go, give it to you!
First of all, before you go see this movie, you cannot look at it as a superhero movie. Yes, it is. He's in spandex and he is a superhero. He's got a comic book devoted to him and he shows up all over the place. And they got X-Men in there. You're tempted to say this is a superhero movie. It's not. It's also not a love story, even though they're sort of trying to back end that into Valentine's Day weekend marketing. This is a comedy. It stars Ryan Reynolds as a comedic superhero in a comedy. Now, the story is him going after revenge, but the reason to see this movie is for the humor and the jokes and the laughs. And yeah, the R-rated violence and the explicit language is cool too, but it's a comedy at its heart. And he's a wisecracker. That's what this movie is. And that's how you have to approach it, and that's how it works. Now, I've heard people start throwing around game changer for Deadpool. I don't think this is a game changer. Even if this does extremely well, I do not think that this is a mandate to suddenly make all movies with superheroes in them, rated R. I do not want to start seeing Avenger movies rated R. I do not want to start seeing an R-rated Superman versus Batman. Suicide Squad, yeah, maybe you could get away with an R-rated version of that, and they might try that, but that's because of who it's marketing for and the characters. And if you go back and read comics and you look at the comics, there are broad comics that are meant for a large reading audience and that they're expecting kids to read, you know, like a 10-year-old kid to read. And then there's more comics for grown-ups. And I remember reading these back in the 80s. The Killing Joke, which is a Batman comic in which the Joker cripples Barbara Gordon, and there's nudity and violence and implied sexual assault. That's not a kid's comic book. The Dark Knight Returns, a Frank Miller book, that's a fantastic book for Batman. It is not for kids. And we see these, and it's okay to have these all exist in the same universe. The bottom line is, it's okay to have a PG-13 superhero movie. It's okay to have an R-rated superhero movie. It's okay to have a G-rated superhero movie, which is essentially what Big Hero 6 was. The only way I would call Deadpool a game changer is if it basically allows studios to make R-rated movies. But not everything needs to be that. And it's not the first one. You had Watchmen, you had Blade, you had Punisher. A couple of those are Marvel titles. So this is not the first time you got an R-rated superhero movie. It's the first time you got an R-rated X-Men movie. But it's a funny movie. Part of it works because Ryan Reynolds was born to play this role, and he's hilarious in it. And he is given a long leash on this one, and that's what makes it worth seeing. So if you want a grown-up, inappropriate, foul-mouthed superhero comedy, this is one to check out. Deadpool rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Southbound. This is a much smaller movie. It's released by The Orchard. Now, Southbound is an anthology horror movie which meshes together four horror stories of people facing terrors on the road.
Well, this next one is for all you lost souls. All you sinners racing down that long road to redemption, but heading straight into that pit of darkness up ahead.
We're all on the same endless highway.
Guys, we have got to go.
I'm not going anywhere.
Help! I need some help!
I don't deserve this.
This is in limited release and on demand. If you can see it in your own theater in your hometown, check it out. I live in Columbus, Ohio, and they have it playing at the Gateway Film Center. It's totally worth seeing, even though it's not the strongest anthology horror film. The people behind the VHS films are behind this. Some of the directors, like Radio Silence, is involved in this. Roxanne Benjamin directed one of these segments. I've always enjoyed anthology horror films. Some are better than others. I mean, you go back to stuff like Nightmares from the 80s. That's not a very good movie, with Emilio Estevez, and Lance Hendrickson was in that one. Or Grim Prairie Tales from the 90s. But I always have loved anthology horror, going back to the old Amicus movies, Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror. And they've also had, of course, the granddaddy of them all would be Creepshow, George Romero's Creepshow with Stephen King. They had the Twilight Zone movie. Some are better than others, but I've always enjoyed just the short form content. And I talked about this when I talked about the Oscar shorts a couple weeks ago. I've always enjoyed short films. And that's essentially what these anthology horror movies are. They're an amalgamation of several short films. And they're a lot of fun. And they're very creative. This one tends not to explain enough. For my tastes, I think they leave too much hidden in trying to tie all the stories together, and it does kind of work into this weird little magic box. But it's worth checking out. It's worth seeing for some original stories, for a different take on independent horror, and some pretty grisly stuff happening, and some pretty strong what if. And I've done a lot of traveling, and this all takes place southbound. I suppose it takes place kind of in the desert. I have driven past and stayed in and stopped at a lot of these kind of locations that are featured in this movie. And for somebody like me who's done that travel and driven through the desert in the middle of the night and encountered some very strange people and strange circumstances in my travels, this is the kind of movie that kind of goes after my heart. And it works because it's creepy and it's a solid film. So it's worth checking out. If you don't have it locally, check it out on demand. That would be Southbound. It kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. When I come back, a couple more things to do. I've got a review Tumble Down. I've got a listener question. And I've also got the box office and the home cinema roundup. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, finalizing the show. We got one more segment, but we got a bunch of stuff to talk about. The first thing I want to do in this segment is finish up the reviews. I want to talk about Tumble Down. And the reason I'm doing this one is it's actually the only bona fide love story out there. And since it's Valentine's weekend and I'm such a ladies man, and I know what the ladies like. I'm sorry. I think people just need a shower after the way I said that. Anyways. Just because I know there's got to be something out there for the couples. Tumble Down, we're going to talk about. Years after the death of her legendary songwriter husband, a woman opens her home to a writer to help develop her husband's biography.
You got 30 seconds to make your case.
Hunter Miles, a sensitive soul who gives us a single, nearly perfect album from the woods of Maine. And then, he's gone. What happened?
Andrew McCabe.
I have a proposition. Have you ever written a biography?
I see what's going on here. You're just a crazy person.
Yes, apparently, because I think that you have half a brain, and I need it.
I will bring my swim trunks. Why do you want to write this book?
Because I had so much love left in my arsenal, and I never got to spend it.
This one stars Rebecca Hall and Jason Sudeikis. Even though Jason Sudeikis kind of plays a bit of a snarky guy, it's a bit of a diversion from what he normally does, because he usually is so brash and out there and... But this one, he's got a little bit of a mouth on him, but he basically plays an associate professor at Hofstra who is trying to track down this music legend who died before his time. Rebecca Hall plays the widow, and she's, of course, still grieving, even though it's been a couple of years. She's still grieving about this guy's death, her husband's death. It was, of course, sudden. Nobody expected it. It was an accident, or, you know, that's at least what they think. And she is trying to reconcile moving on with keeping his memory alive. In a weird way, this reminds me a little bit of The End of the Tour, which came out last year. And that starred Jason Segel and Jesse Eisenberg. And it was another one of those interviewee kind of movies about trying to get the true story behind something. It also involved the death of the character, of course. And in this movie, the character's dead from the beginning because they're... looking at this legendary songwriter. And in The End of the Tour, it was the character flashing back to when they were having this time after the character kills himself. It's a love story, and it's very clear from the beginning that it's going to be a story of Rebecca Hall's character having to let go. And this other guy comes into her life, and that's obviously the dynamic that it takes. And I mean, it's well acted and it's very charming. It takes place up in Maine and the scenery's gorgeous. And it makes me want to move there. And, you know, they're in a cabin and they got sweaters on and it's cold and they got a fire going. And I'm like, I'd love to live like that. I'd love to live in an isolated cabin because it'll be awesome. And then it'll be a horror show one day. My life will become a Cabin in the Woods movie. But ultimately, Tumble Down works. The only reason I just wasn't totally on board with it is I'm not a music guy. And this hinges its story and importance on there being that songwriter who is legendary, and it's really hard to create somebody like that out of nowhere. The closest you have on something like that would be like, in recent memory, and we're talking 20 years ago, would be like Kurt Cobain, who died young under, it was mysterious circumstances. But I've never gotten into the worship of a dead rock star. I've just never been into that. and this hinges upon it so much. And I think it also takes too long to get through what it needs to do. You know where the movie's going because that's the point of the film. And it just takes so long to get there and make that leap. So I'm going to ultimately say that Tumble Down just barely kind of rocks because it works as a movie. So Tumble Down kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into a quick listener question. This comes from our good friend, Red State Gabe. And he says, I quote, after recently watching the unintentionally hilarious Roar, I noticed a ton of ADR. Can you recall times you found ADR to be distracting or a poor choice of the director who didn't believe in the final product? First of all, if you don't remember Roar was that movie that I covered this last year. It was shot in the 80s, and it was Timpi Hedren and her husband, and they found the house of jungle cats in Africa, and they shot a movie there with wild animals. And people were injured on set. I mean, Jan de Bont was a cinematographer, and I think he got injured. Melanie Griffith got injured and had to have reconstructive surgery. It was a very dangerous production. Now, if you don't know what ADR is, it stands for additional dialogue recording. Another term you'll hear is looping. Basically, if you have set recording, if you record sound on the set and either the sound's bad or you're unable to get the sound. A great example is there's a scene in Seven where they're driving, in the movie Seven, David Fincher Seven, where they're driving and Brad Pitt's talking to Kevin Spacey in the back and they have this whole dialogue. Well, obviously this was before digital effects so you can get a realistic looking background. They did it in a real car. It just, the car was so loud, they couldn't get good set sounds, so they had to loop all those lines. They had to do ADR. Well, if you do it really well and you know what you're doing and you've shot it and you are prepared for that, you can do it and have it unnoticeable. People don't even notice ADR sometimes. But you get a lot of bad ADR and bad looping in movies, so that happens. And Roar is filled with it. And why? Because it was shot in a house of jungle cats that were wild animals who weren't going to shut up when you said, hey, quiet on set. There was no way to stop a lion from roaring or growling or pooping in the middle of a scene. So there's going to be background noise that is uncontrollable. So they had to loop a lot of stuff. Now, to answer your question, Red State Gabe, I notice bad ADR all the time. And it doesn't take me out of the movie. Because usually when it's bad ADR, it's either in such a low budget movie that there's so many other problems with it that I'm just like, that's just one of the many problems. Where I notice it is where you can tell they're intentionally either changing dialogue and the lips don't match, even though it sounds fine, or when they have the reverse angle of the person, you can tell their mouth isn't moving. And it's just, this is just the construct of movies. It doesn't bother. It doesn't really take me out of the movies. And I don't necessarily think it's that the director doesn't believe in the final product. A lot of times it's just, you're not able to get the on-set recording. And especially if you're talking about a movie that was made in 1980, there's a lot of things that can go wrong that they couldn't get rid of. You know, now you could, there's the technology can allows you to do so much more. So to answer your question, no, I've never found it so distracting that it ruined the movie for me, but I see it happen all the time. And I see it happen in big movies, TV all the time. Hope that answers your question well enough. And it's time to move on. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Last week I said Kung Fu Panda would win with $25 million. I was close. It made $21 million over Super Bowl weekend. The new movie, Hail Caesar, came in a far second with a little over $11 million. And then The Choice was at $6 million and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies was at $5.3. This was not a good weekend for big money-making movies. Pride and Prejudice and Zombies probably took it on the chin the hardest. Choice probably took it on the chin as well. Part of those two movies is there's no big names in them to really drag anybody to see them. The reason Hail Caesar made what those films made combined is because it had such a great cast. Even though most of mainstream America doesn't quite get the Coen brothers, you throw George Clooney and Scarlett Johansson and Josh Brolin and all these names in a movie, you're going to get at least people being interested. Star power works to a degree. Now, it's not going to give you a $50 million opening weekend for one that's only going to make 11. So it was kind of a soft weekend last week. And I think it all has to do with star powers and cast. This week, Deadpool is the one to beat. I'm seeing box office predictions, $70 million plus for the four-day weekend. I don't think it's going to make that much. I'm going to the lower end of predictions, and I'm going to say $65 million. And part of the reason is while R-rated movies during Valentine's Day weekend tend to do well, like 50 Shades of Grey, which made like $90 million last year, this, I think, is going to be very front-loaded. I think it's going to be fan-driven. I still think they're going to do well. Still, $65 million ain't bad for this movie. I think it's got a $50 million budget. But again, it's not going to be a game changer. Zoolander 2, I think, is good for about 25 due to soft reviews and the 15-year lag. And the star power that's drained from everybody in the cast. Ben Stiller, Owen Wilson, Will Ferrell, Penelope Cruz, and even Justin Bieber are not the draws that they were 5, 10, 15 years ago. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. You've got Spectre, the 23rd James Bond movie that came out, 24th. I just bought the full box set, so now I've got to go get Spectre. I got that for Christmas. I got a really good deal on Amazon. So now I have to get Spectre just to complete the set, even though it's not my favorite James Bond movie. Crimson Peak is a fantastic-looking movie. Guillermo del Toro doing gothic horror. Totally worth checking out. Love the Coopers is a Christmas movie. Oddly releasing in February, so I think it's just going to disappear. Also, Grandma with Lily Tomlin in an award-worthy performance. 99 Homes, which is worth seeing, considering it's somewhat politically driven and it deals with, especially if you're following what some of the candidates are saying, it's an interesting movie. And then A Mighty Wind on Blu-ray. This is Christopher Guest's movie he made about... 15 years ago. And it was about folk singers and very funny, that sort of mockumentary style. That's it for this week. I need to go to a break and spend some time with my lovely and gracious wife this holiday weekend. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Race, Risen, and The Witch. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.